Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 952. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Update on technocratic fascism. This is being recorded on March 30th of the year 2015. We have spoken of and about what I have termed technocratic fascism in numerous programs in the past. Please access the website and take a look at and or listen to those programs, because we have a lot of material to cover. What do I mean by technocratic fascism? Well, just one example of this. And again, when I say be afraid, be very afraid, this is what I'm talking about. People think the internet is such a cool thing. In particular, I feel sorry for and alarmed about the prospects of young people. Generally speaking, our society handles all people very cynically, but the young basically are subjected to any number of Pied Piper manifestations. And for young people who have grown up with the internet and social networking and mobile technology, well, I feel sorry for them. Why? Well, they are being absolutely reamed by things that they not only aren't alarmed about, but things that they love. An example of that, the online game or the Pokemon Go game available for your smartphone, what have you. This from Network World of July 22nd of 2016. This is by someone who calls themselves Linux, L-I-N-U-X, of course, Tycoon. Title, The CIA, NSA, and Pokemon Go. Now, we want you to, there is much to contemplate in this. First of all, note that John Hanke, or Hanke, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, H-A-N-K-E, was the founder of Keyhole Incorporated. That is an interesting company. It ultimately produced something called Earth, which became Google Earth. And ultimately, John Hanke, the founder of that, founded Niantic Labs, which was originally founded under Google, of the auspices of Google. Then it became its own company, and it developed Pokemon Go. About some of the elements underlying those things, again, the CIA, NSA, and Pokemon Go by Linux Tycoon from Network World, 7/22/2016. Skipping down. Way back in 2001, Keyhole Incorporated was founded by John Hanke, or Hanke, H-A-N-K-E, who previously worked in a, quote, foreign affairs, unquote, position within the U.S. government. The company was named after the old eye-in-the-sky military satellites. One of the key early backers of Keyhole Incorporated by John Hanke, founded by John Hanke, was a firm called InQtel. InQtel is the venture capital arm of the CIA. Yes, the Central Intelligence Agency. Much of the funding purportedly came from the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, or NGA. The NGA handles combat support for the U.S. Department of Defense and provides intelligence to the NSA and CIA, among others. Keyhole's noteworthy public product was Earth, quote unquote, renamed to Google Earth after Google acquired Keyhole in 2004. So when you check out Google Earth, bear in mind it was developed by Keyhole. And we have talked about that company's background. Now, on to Pokemon Go. In 2010, Niantic, capital N-I-A-N-T-I-C, Labs, was founded inside of Google by Keyhole's founder, John Hanke, or Hanke, H-A-N-K-E, skipping down. In 2015, Niantic was spun off from Google and became its own company. Then, Pokemon Go was developed and launched by Niantic. It's a game where you walk around in the real world between locations suggested by the service while holding your smartphone. So again, note the heritage of Keyhole and note the heritage of Niantic and the fact that John Hankey, quote, previously in a foreign affairs position within the U.S. government, founded both companies and funded in part by InQtel and the CIA. That is the venture capital arm of CIA. Now, in terms of what the game can access, one of the things I should note in passing here is that one of the cruel illusions to which people have been subjected, young people in particular, is that their online activities are private. Particularly not these days, but no, they are not. In our discussions of Eddie Snowden et al., I have noted that the online world is anything but private. And really, the NSA is about the last thing people should be worried about. They should be worried about just about everything else in terms of federal intelligence services, CIA, which is to whom Snowden belongs, and the elements around him. More about that later. Now, about Pokemon Go. Data the game can access. Listen to this. And for those of you, particularly young people, you like Pokemon Go, you'll love this. The writer says, let's move on to what information Pokemon Go has access to, bearing the history of the company in mind as we do so. When you install Pokemon Go on an Android phone, you grant it the following access, not including the ability to make in-app purchases. Identity. Find accounts on the device. Contacts. Find accounts on the device. Location. Precise location, GPS and network-based. Approximate location, network-based. For those media files. Modify or delete the contents of your USB storage. Read the contents of your USB storage. Storage. Modify or delete the contents of your USB storage. Read the contents of your USB storage. Camera. Take pictures and videos. Other. Receive data from the internet. Control vibration. Pair with Bluetooth devices. Access Bluetooth settings. Full network access. Use accounts on the device. View network connections. Prevent the device from sleeping. Based on the access to your device and your information, coupled with the design of Pokemon Go, the game should have no problem discerning and storing the following information just for a start. Where you are, where you were, what route you took between those locations, when you were at each location, how long it took you to get between them, what you are looking at right now, what you were looking at in the past, what you look like, what files you have on your device, and the entire contents of those files. There's a lot of other stuff, too. Modifying or deleting the contents of your USB storage camera. Take pictures and videos. You like that? Oh, this will be wonderful. Receive data from the internet, control vibration. Pair with Bluetooth devices. Access Bluetooth devices. Oh, man, I'll tell you. that's some game, isn't it? Noting all of the connections there and all of the possibilities for abuse. We're going to take a look now at the Pokemon Go, obviously originally developed by Nintendo, the Pokemon Go's strategic position within the top-down, renascent Japanese fascism. Pokemon Go has been seen as a key player for what has been known as the Cool Japan strategy. There actually was a minister, Tomi Imada, who was minister of the Cool Japan strategy. This was implemented by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe of Japan, and it falls under the economic development of his government. The finance minister of Japan is a guy named Taro, T-A-R-O, Aso, A-S-O, I may be mispronouncing that. He is also the deputy prime minister. Bear in mind Tomomi Inaba and Mr. Taro Aso. More about them in a minute.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at SpitfireList.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Of Pokemon Go and the Cool Japan. This from The Diplomat of July 29th of 2016, an article by Henry Lawrence. Will Pokemon Go power up Japan's cool economy? Is Pokemon Go a game changer for the Japanese economy? Within days of its release in early July, a record 21 million people were playing at once, tracking down and capturing the cute little monsters on their smartphones. Creator Nintendo's shares soared, but the phenomenal popularity of the game raises important questions beyond just, where's the nearest Pokégym, unquote. Is it a sign that Silicon Valley-style innovation is reinvigorating corporate Japan's notoriously insular management? Might this be the first big success story for Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's Cool Japan initiative, a key element in the structural reforms promised but so far undelivered by Abenomics? Skipping down. In 2013, amid great fanfare, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe announced a Cool Japan promotion fund, unquote, to raise the international profile of the country's mass culture. The need for such a fund, currently set at about $1 billion, is itself an interesting reflection on how little faith policymakers seem to have in the economic clout of the nation's artists. Questions also remain about the helpfulness of elderly politicians dabbling in the creative sector. I love that phraseology. We're going to take a look at some of the elderly politicians dabbling in the creative sector. How creative does this sound? From the Daily Beast of July 26th of 2014, article by Jake Adelstein, A-D-E-L-E-S-T-E-I-N, and Angela Erica Kubo, K-U-B-O. For top polls in Japan, crime doesn't pay, but hate crime does. Skipping down. According to the magazine Sunday Mainichi, Ms. Tomomi Inaba, minister of the Cool Japan strategy, also received donations from Masakai and other Zaitokukai associates. That is a militant anti-Korean bigoted organization. Continuing. Apparently, racism is cool in Japan. Tomomi Inaba made news earlier this month after photos circulated of her and another female in the new cabinet posing with a neo-Nazi party leader. Both denied knowing the neo-Nazi, both denied knowing the neo-Nazi well, but later were revealed to have contributed blurbs for an advertisement praising the out-of-print book Hitler's Election Strategy. Coincidentally, Vice Prime Minister, and I will add Finance Minister and head of the economy, Taro Aso, T-A-R-O-A-S-O, is also a long-time admirer of Nazi political strategy and has suggested that Japan follow the Nazi Party template to sneak constitutional change past the public. Skipping down. In August, Japan's ruling party, which put Abe into power, organized a working group to discuss laws that would restrict hate crime, although the new laws will probably be used to clamp down on anti-nuclear protests outside the Diet building. Of course, it is a little worrisome that Sanae, S-A-N-A-E, Takaichi, T-A-K-A-I-C-H-I, who was supposed to oversee the anti-hate crimes project, is the other female minister who was photographed with a neo-Nazi leader and who also is a fan of Hitler. If that's cool Japan, well, perhaps we differ in our definitions. Tomomi Inaba has moved up in life. Reviewing again from Reuters of August 3rd of 2016 by Elaine Lyes, L-I-E-S, and Kiyoshi Takanaka, K-I-Y-L-S-H-I-T-A-K-E-N-A-K-A. Japan's PM picks hawkish defense minister for new cabinet, vows economic recovery. Skipping down. New defense minister Tomomi Inaba, previously the ruling party policy chief, shares Abe's goal of revising the post-war pacifist constitution, which some conservatives consider a humiliating symbol of Japan's World War II defeat. Inaba also regularly visits Tokyo's Yasukuni Shrine for the War Dead, which China and South Korea see as a symbol of Japan's past militarism. Japan's ties with China and South Korea have been frayed by the legacy of its military aggression before and during World War II. The point being here that the cool Japan strategy was presided over by people like Taro Azo and Tomomi Inaba, by people who are admirers of Adolf Hitler's political strategy. Pokemon Go itself basically will enable users of that who install a game on an Android phone to become completely transparent. The almost mind-numbing array of possibilities that opens up, detailed in the article from Network World. Assessing the data mining possibilities of Pokemon Go, the profound intelligence background and foundation of the development of Niantic, and the Japanese fascist nature and beyond that Nazi nature of the key people in the quote cool Japan ministry strategy of Shinzo Abe, consider the following, and bear in mind as we listen to this, the Cambridge Analytica, Steve Bannon, Robert Mercer, in effect Nazified artificial intelligence backed by billions of dollars worth of supercomputers and using big data, including and especially information from Facebook, to develop some truly awesome profiling of the American electorate, among others. More about Pokemon Go. This from the Vocative blog, V-O-C-A-T-I-V, from September 7th of 2016 by James King and Adi A-D-I Cohen, C-O-H-E-N. Alt-right recruiting kids with Pokemon Go Nazi challenge. Subtitled, alt-right neo-Nazis are targeting kids as young as 10 years old with Pikachu dressed as Hitler. I may be mispronouncing that. Skipping down. Andrew Anglin, the neo-Nazi wordsmith behind the alt-right Daily Stormer blog, posted a story on Tuesday about an enterprising Stormer, a follower of Anglin's blog, who is finding Pokemon Go gyms which serve as battlegrounds for players and distributing recruitment flyers to kids with the hope of, quote, converting children and teens to hardcore neo-Nazism, unquote. The Daily Stormer was designed to appeal to teenagers, but I have long thought that we needed to get preteens involved in the movement, Anglin wrote in the blog post, again quoting, at that age you can really brainwash someone easily. Anyone who accepts Nazism at the age of 10 or 11 is going to be a Nazi for life, he added. and it isn't hard. It's just a matter of pulling them in. And what better way to do it than with Pokemon flyers at the Pokemon Go gym? Skipping down. The flyer features run-of-the-mill neo-Nazi propaganda. It rails on Jews, African Americans, and claims a, quote, white genocide, unquote, is happening, and white people need to stand up and prepare for the impending race war. The first step, the flyer explains, is electing Donald Trump president. Step two is to, quote, get active in the Nazi movement, unquote, because, again, quoting, the alt-right Nazis are the only ones who can save this country from the kikes, unquote. Adolf Hitler was a great man, the flyer under the title Hey White Boy explains. Just as you want to catch all the Pokemon, he hunted a different type of monster. Jews, skipping down. And that pretty much says that, I think, in the interests of time, we're going to move on. Note this, though. Anglin has created a PDF file of the flyer so other, quote, stormers, unquote, can print them out and distribute them at Pokemon Go gyms, and even provided a map showing the locations of gyms across the country. These hot spots are packed, he wrote. No doubt you'll be able to hand out 130 minutes easily if you live in a decent-sized urban area. Get in and get out. Take a buddy with you, unquote. Of particular note here, just imagine the artificial intelligence and the billions of dollars of supercomputers that are hooked up to it, and the massive big data, information base available to that we have looked at in a number of programs, 946, 948, and 949, dealing with Cambridge Analytica and its parent company, SCL. Robert Mercer and his daughter, Rebecca Mercer, I, by the way, mistakenly identified Rebecca as Robert's wife. They often speak about them as Robert and Rebecca Mercer. They are actually father and daughter. Robert Mercer's wife is Diana. She is Rebecca Mercer's daughter. But it is primarily Robert and his daughter, Rebecca, who are politically active. Their political guru is Steve Bannon. There is an article that has had a fair amount of discussion. It is from the New Yorker magazine of March 27th of 2017, article by Jane Mayer, the author of Dark Money, or maybe it's Black Money, Dark Money. It's about the Koch brothers. The reclusive hedge fund tycoon behind the Trump presidency. This has a number of interesting things, just highlighting some aspects of this. Reviewing again Robert Mercer's position in the, quote, alt-right. In February, David Magerman, or Magerman, M-A-G-E-R-M-A-N, a senior employee at Renaissance Technologies, spoke out about what he regards as Mercer's worrisome influence. Magerman, a Democrat who is a strong supporter of Jewish causes, took particular issue with Mercer's empowerment of the alt-right, which has included anti-Semitic and white supremacist voices. We've spoken about that before, but it can certainly stand with some reinforcement. More about Mercer. Mercer, for his part, has argued that the Civil Rights Act in 1964 was a major mistake. According to the one-time Renaissance employee, Mercer has asserted repeatedly that African Americans were better off economically before the Civil Rights Movement. He has also said that the problem of racism in America is exaggerated. The source said that not long ago, he heard Mercer proclaim that there are no white racists in America today, only black racists. That is an interesting viewpoint, obviously. A white supremacist viewpoint, although Mercer himself denies being a white supremacist. He does back alt-right causes. This information was provided by a Renaissance Technologies employee who insisted on anonymity. That is not the aforementioned David Magerman. We have noted in the past that some of the key technological research that Mercer undertook was for IBM. IBM developed the Holorith machine, which was used to catalog Jewish victims of the Holocaust by Nazi Germany, and also for other data management functions in Nazi Germany. Thomas J. Watson, the head of IBM and the man after whom IBM's artificial intelligence, Watson, was named, was one of the recipients of the Order of the German Eagle. That is the highest award that Nazi Germany gave to a foreigner. Two of the previous recipients were Mussolini and Henry Ford. IBM was not the only source behind the development of Mercer's bedrock technology that ultimately went into this artificial intelligence in part, and the supercomputers and the massive big data information base behind it. DARPA, formerly the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, also was involved with the development of Mercer's project. Reading from Mayer's story, yet when IBM failed to offer adequate support for Mercer and Brown's translation project, they secured additional funding from DARPA, the secretive Pentagon program. Despite Mercer's disdain for big government, unquote, this funding was essential to his early success. Now, understand that this, in effect, Nazified artificial intelligence hooked up to billions of dollars of supercomputers and accessing vast amounts of data is at work by Cambridge Analytica. It's working on Facebook and all over the web. A little detail here, and we'll take this up again when we get through talking about the Bernie Sanders phenomenon. Speaking of a 2012 Citizens United film that was directed against the Obama campaign, many of these disillusioned Obama voters became the central figures of, quote, the hope and the change, unquote, an anti-Obama film that Bannon and Citizens United released during the 2012 Democratic National Convention. After Pat Cadell saw the film, he pointed out to Bannon that its opening imitated that of Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will, the 1935 ode to Hitler made by the Nazi filmmaker. Bannon laughed and said, "You're the only one that caught it." In both films, a plane flies over a blighted land as ominous music swells, then clouds in the sky part, auguring a new era. So a little bit of the Nazi cinematography embraced by Steve Bannon in this, for his film, The Hope and the Change. And bear in mind that it is Steve Bannon, about whom we've spoken so many times, who is the he's the political guru for the Mercers, and he is someone that is in a position to use the, in effect, Nazified artificial intelligence, the billions of dollars of supercomputers that are hooked up to it, and also the vast amount of data. And one should take a look at Pokemon Go, both its Nazified version and its scary enough version, and the Japanese Nazi-oriented government figures who are presiding over the Cool Japan strategy. Well, that should be looked at in the context of that Nazified AI.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
There is a really good and very, very short book called The Politics of Bitcoin, Software, as Right-Wing Extremism. It's authored by David Columbia. That's G as in George, O-L-U-M-B-I-A, like Columbia University, with a G at the beginning. Put out in soft cover by the University of Minnesota Press. It is a very short book. It's only 77 pages of main text. Nonetheless, it is not a simple read because it is dense and very academically oriented. One of the things that the book points out is not only that the ideology behind Bitcoin, that he calls it right-wing extremism, I would call it fascism, it is at one with the anti-Semitic and Nazified anti-Federal Reserve discussion that one sees. Ron Paul is a big backer of Bitcoin. And one of the things the book does is to discuss how libertarian political and social and economic philosophy inevitably hews toward fascism or corporatism, as Mussolini termed fascism. From the concluding pages of the book, let's read the following. As objects, again, this from The Politics of Bitcoin Software as Right-Wing Extremism by David Columbia. As objects of discourse, Bitcoin and the blockchain do a remarkable job of reinforcing the view that the entire global history of political thought and action needs to be jettisoned, or even worse, that it has already been jettisoned through the introduction of any number of technologies. Thus, in the introduction to a bizarrely earnest and destructive volume called From Bitcoin to Burning Man and Beyond, the editors, one of whom is a research scientist at MIT, write, "Enlightenment ideals of democratic rule seem to have run their course. A continuous flow of scientific findings are undermining many foundational claims about human rationality and perfectibility, while exponential technological changes and exploding global demographics overwhelm the capacity of democratic institutions to rule effectively and ultimately their very legitimacy." That passage again. "Enlightenment ideals and democratic rules seem to have run their course. A continuous flow of scientific findings are undermining many foundational claims about human rationality and perfectibility, while exponential technological changes and exploding global demographics overwhelm the capacity of democratic institutions to rule effectively and ultimately their very legitimacy itself. Such abrupt dismissals of hundreds of," that's unquote, and then the Columbia continues, "such abrupt dismissals of hundreds of years of thought, work, and lies follow directly from libertarian thought and extremist reinterpretations of political institutions. What once required the authority of a central bank or a sovereign authority can now be achieved through open, distributed crypto algorithms. National borders, traditional legal regimes, and human intervention are increasingly moot," unquote. Like most ideological formations, these sentiments are highly resistant to being proven false by fact. Skipping down again. "Few attitudes typify the paradoxical cyber-libertarian mindset of Bitcoin promoters and many others more than do those of Sanjuro, S-A-N-J-U-R-O, the alias of the person who created a Bitcoin assassination market. Sanjuro believes that by incentivizing people to kill politicians, he will destroy all governments everywhere," unquote. "This anarchic apocalypse," again quoting, "will change the world for the better," unquote, producing a world without wars, dragnet panopticon-style surveillance, nuclear weapons, armies, repression, money manipulation, and limits to trade, unquote. And Columbia goes on to comment, "Only someone so blinkered by their ideological tunnel vision can look at world history and imagine that murdering the representatives of democratically elected governments and thus putting the governments themselves out of existence would do anything but make every one of these problems immeasurably worse than they already are. Yet this, in the end, is the extreme rightist, anarcho-capitalist, winner-take-all, even neo-feudalist political vision too many of those in the Bitcoin, along with other cryptocurrency and blockchain communities, whatever they believe their political orientation to be, are working actively to bring about. More about this, and we're going to bring this up to the immediate present in a second. More from the politics of Bitcoin, software as right-wing extremism. Among the clearest target of these movements, see both the Cypherpunks Manifesto, Hughes 1993, and the closely related Crypto Anarchist Manifesto from May of 1992, has always specifically been governmental oversight of financial and other transactions. Note that Cypherpunk's Manifesto was published by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. More about that in just a minute. Repeating, among the clearest targets of these movements has always specifically been government oversight of financial and other transactions. No effort is made to distinguish between legitimate and illegitimate use of government power. Rather, all government power is inherently taken to be illegitimate. Further, despite occasional rhetorical nods toward corporate abuses, such as in Murray Rothbard's work, strictly speaking, no mechanisms whatsoever are posited that actually might constrain corporate power, combined with either an explicit commitment toward, or at best, an extreme naivete about the operation of concentrated capital. This political theory works to deprive the people of their only proven mechanism for that constraint of corporate power. This is why as august an anti-government thinker as Noam Chomsky can have declared that libertarian theories, despite surface appearances, promote, quote, corporate tyranny, meaning tyranny by unaccountable private concentrations of power, the worst kind of tyranny you can imagine, the corporate state. And we're going to take a look at one of the people who was espousing just that, again from the politics of Bitcoin, in its most basic and limited form. Cyber-libertarianism is sometimes summarized as the principle that, quote, governments should not regulate the Internet. This belief was articulated with particular force in the 1996 Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace, unquote, written by the libertarian activist, Grateful Dead lyricist, Electronic Frontier Foundation founder. EFF is a leading digital rights and technology industry advocacy organization, John Perry Barlow, which declared that, quote, governments of our industrial world, unquote, are, quote, not welcome, unquote, in and have no sovereignty, unquote, over the digital system. This again from John Perry Barlow, one of the founders of the EFF. Governments of our industrial world are not welcome in and have no sovereignty over the digital system. In addition to being a Grateful Dead lyricist and EFF co-founder, which he is and was, John Perry Barlow was also at one point Dick Cheney's campaign manager, and he also was a supporter of George Wallace, the 1968 segregationist presidential candidate. He also helped to introduce the Grateful Dead to Timothy Leary, whose CIA background we discussed in the AFA program number 28. And in addition, Mr. John Perry Barlow is also a member of, has worked with the Central Intelligence Agency. From a Forbes magazine article from October 7th of 2002, this is a story called Why Spy by John Perry Barlow. And in this, he discusses being invited to CIA headquarters and helping to turn them on to some very interesting things indeed. I would note that the CIA is not in the habit of inviting hippies and acid heads to their headquarters. It looks very much here like John Perry Barlow also had some sort of profound relationship with CIA, but he brought with him some seminal concepts which may very well have spawned social media, or certainly are resonant with the concept of social media and may have had much to do with their generation. This to be seen against the background of Cambridge Analytica, Robert Mercer, Steve Bannon, Pokemon Go, Niantic, and all of the nightmarish things that we looked at earlier. From Why Spy by John Perry Barlow, from October 7th of 2002, discussing John Perry Barlow was involved with. This, again, invited to CIA headquarters in 2002. They told me they brought Steve Jobs in a few weeks before to indoctrinate them in modern information management. And they were delighted when I returned later, bringing with me a platform of internet gurus, including Esther Dyson, Mitch Kapoor, Tony Rutkowski, and Vint Cerf. They sealed us into an electronically impenetrable room to discuss the radical possibility that a good first step in lifting their blackout would be for the CIA to put up a website. And skipping down, Barlow suggests, let's create a process of information digestion in which inexpensive data are gathered from largely open sources and condensed through an open process into knowledge terse and insightful enough to inspire wisdom in our leaders. The entity I envision would be small, highly networked, and generally visible. It would be open to information from all available sources and would classify only information that arrived classified. It would rely heavily on the internet, public media, the academic press, and an informal worldwide network of volunteers, a kind of global neighborhood watch that would submit on-the-ground reports. It would use off-the-shelf technology and use it less for gathering data than for collating and communicating them. Being off-the-shelf, it could deploy tools while they were still state-of-the-art. I imagine this entity staffed initially with librarians, journalists, linguists, scientists, technologists, philosophers, sociologists, cultural historians, and goes on, and artists, a lot like the original CIA, the OSS under Wild Bill Donovan. Its budget would be under the direct authority of the president, acting through the National Security Advisor. That, again, from John Perry Barlow, suggestions he made when he was invited to CIA headquarters. This from someone who, in his declaration of the independence of cyberspace, said the government has no place in cyberspace. Apparently, he was not altogether sincere in that. No one wonders. Perhaps he was more sincere when he was managing Dick Cheney's campaigns or supporting George Wallace in 1968. The notion that the government had no place in cyberspace is, of course, consistent with the libertarian right-wing Republican points of view that have found expression under Donald Trump. There have been some recent steps in that regard, and I'm sure people are aware of them. I have linked to a comment by the insightful Tara Fractal, an article from the New York Times, an op-ed piece, How the Republicans Sold Your Privacy to Internet Providers, this by Tom Wheeler, and a Donald Trump executive ruling has reinforced this.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
This is from the Times of March 29th, 2017. This is a House bill. The bill not only gives cable companies and wireless providers free rein to do what they like with your browsing history, shopping habits, your location, and other information gleaned from your online activity, but it would also prevent the Federal Communications Commission from ever again establishing similar consumer privacy protections. The bill is an effort by the FCC's new Republican majority and congressional Republicans to overturn a simple but vitally important concept, namely that the information that goes over a network belongs to you as the consumer and not to the network hired to carry it. And again, an executive ruling by Donald Trump has basically empowered tech companies to pretty much do what they want with your information. Skipping down, the Trump FCC recently voted to stay requirements that Internet service providers must take, quote, reasonable measures, unquote, to protect confidential information they hold on their customers, such as social security numbers and credit card information. This is not a hypothetical risk. In 2015, AT&T was fined $25 million for shoddy practices that allowed employees to steal and sell the private information of 280,000 AT&T customers. Now, the door has been opened to that to happen, and this is the logical outgrowth of the policies advocated by people like John Perry Barlow, Julian Assange, and many others, Assange, and Jacob Applebaum, who is financed by the Open Technology Fund, a subsidiary element of Radio Free Asia, again, a subsidiary element of CIA. Well, this is where the whole libertarian philosophy goes. The book by David Golombia talks about Ron Paul, an unabashed white supremacist defender of the Confederacy and advocate of the neo-Confederate movement, as one of the people who espouses these kinds of things. And this is basically what people have embraced. I've spoken about Julian Assange and the Nazi and fascist underpinnings and manifestations of WikiLeaks, which, frankly, almost in its entirety, is the antithesis of the wonderful, empowering, freedom-loving organization it is made out to be. Just one note in that regard. From BuzzFeed of October 23rd of 2016 by James Ball. Inside the paranoid, strange world of Julian Assange. And skipping down. Speaking of WikiLeaks, now it is the darling of the alt-right, revealing hacked emails seemingly to influence a presidential contest, claiming the U.S. election is, quote, rigged, unquote, and descending into conspiracy. Just this week on Twitter, it described the deaths by natural causes of two of its supporters as a bloody year for WikiLeaks, unquote, and warned of media outlets, quote, controlled by, unquote, members of the Rothschild family, a common anti-Semitic trope. We know in For the Record 745 that when people took issue with the fact that Assange had a fellow named Joran, J-O-R-A-N, Jermas, J-E-R-M-A-S, a.k.a., quote, Israel Shamir, unquote, as one of his top aides. Jermas is a doctrinaire Holocaust denier and someone who moves in the same political circles as David Duke and the, quote, alt-right Nazis. Julian Assange claimed that he was the victim of an international Jewish conspiracy, unquote, when people took issue with WikiLeaks basically having, with Roger Stone having basically manifested as the online dirty tricks component to the Trump campaign. Once again, WikiLeaks said that all of our critics are Jews. They posted on the internet posting that maintained that its critics were all, quote, Jews, unquote. As we have looked at In For the Record 745, it was that very same Jaron Jermas who arranged for WikiLeaks to hold forth on the Pirate Bay website. Now, the Pirate Bay website, on which WikiLeaks was located for quite some time, was financed by Carl, C-A-R-L, Lundstrom, L-U-N-D-S-T-R-O-N, a man who got his capital from Sandoz, that is the Swiss pharmaceutical company that was the original developer of LSD. LSD was developed invented LSD, which was then developed first by the Nazi SS as an incapacitating agent and later adopted by and disseminated by the CIA as part of its mind control programs. Think about John Perry Barlow and the Grateful Dead in that regard. It was Jaron Jermas who arranged for WikiLeaks to hold forth on the Pirate Bay website, hosted by one of Sweden's premier fascists, Carl Lundstrom. Now, a guy who is part of the same Swedish fascist milieu as Carl Lundstrom is a guy named Daniel Freiberg, F-R-I-B-E-R-G, reviewing from, For the Record, 951 from Slate Magazine of January 27th of 2017, an article by Osita, O-S-I-T-A, Nuavenu, N-W-A-V-E-N-U. Richard Spencer and his alt-right buddies launch a new website. Richard Spencer is the alt-right supporter of Donald Trump, who held a rally a few blocks from the White House in November, at which he read verbatim in German from Third Reich anti-Semitic technology and led his followers in a chant of Heil Trump. On Monday, Richard Spencer, New Jersey Institute of Technology lecturer Jason Giorgiani, and Swedish New Right figure Daniel Freiberg launched altright.com, and what they draw on in large measure. As of now, most of the site's content is recycled material from Freiberg's Arctos Publishing House. And Arctos Publishing House is what basically emerged from Nordic Publishers, from the Realtid.se blog of March 10th of 2006. The Goal, Take Over All Piracy by Peter Carlson, K-A-R-L-S-S-O-N, and it talks about Carl Lundstrom. And Nordic Publishers: "You and the media are full of hatred to the Pirate Bay," finishing a very upset Carl Lundstrom. This is from the Google translation here. "Lundstrom has made no secret of his sympathy for the xenophobic groups, and last year was his name with the customer code of the Nazi publishing house Nordic Publishers." Also from the Google translation, this from the late Stig Larsson's Expo magazine of January of 2014. "Right-wing public education" by Maria Pia Cabero, C-A-B-E-R-O. The publisher Arctos was founded by the same people. Arctos publishes new right-inspired literature, and CEO Daniel Freiberg, who was the driving force in Nordic Publishers, has played a key role in the establishment of ideas. The point being here that Daniel Freiberg, part of the Swedish fascist milieu to which Carl Lundstrom is part and parcel, has now founded a website with Richard Spencer. One of the things that I spoke about in connection with WikiLeaks is that with Carl Lundstrom's Pirate Bay website being the epicenter for WikiLeaks, it undoubtedly permitted tremendous data mining of the people who visited that website. Just think about how many individuals and how many institutions visited WikiLeaks. Furthermore, their browsing habits, their searching habits, and what they were reading, what they were paying attention to, was undoubtedly being databased by this Carl Lundstrom finance entity. Now, just think about people like Daniel Freiberg and Richard Spencer and their new website, and think about the Robert Mercer Cambridge Analytica, in effect, Nazified artificial intelligence implemented in part by Steve Bannon. I think we can assume that all of the almost unimaginably vast data that all of the, the wiki suckers, because the people who have been beguiled by WikiLeaks are just that. All of that information is, I think we can assume, is being utilized by the Nazified artificial intelligence that is at the core of Cambridge Analytica, the Trump and Confabanda, as I call it, and the efforts of the sinister but altogether brilliant Steve Bannon. And I would note that the data mined by those who visited the Pirate Bay site and WikiLeaks would not only go for alt-rightists who then could be targeted by various things, it would not only include kids who ultimately could be the focal point of some of the Nazified Pokemon Go things, but it would also include progressives who then could have information which would favor, say, Bernie Sanders as opposed to Hillary Clinton, channeled to them as well. We're going to close with an article that I read into the record in For the Record 950. This from the Guardian publication of March 13th of 2017 by Olivia Solon, S-O-L-O-N, noting various things here. Note that Palantir, that is one of Peter Thiel's firms, Peter Thiel being one of the principal stockholders in Facebook and someone who sits on the Facebook board, and also one of the main financial, an important aide to Donald Trump, a backer of Donald Trump, and a key member of his transition team. Palantir is developing an immigrant database for use by the Trump administration. And this is called Artificial Intelligence is Ripe for Abuse, Tech Researcher Warns, A Fascist's Dream, skipping down. Just as we are seeing a step function increase in the spread of artificial intelligence, something else is happening. The rise of ultranationalism, right-wing authoritarianism, and fascism, she said. All of these movements, this, by the way, is Kate Crawford, a Microsoft researcher, all of these movements have shared characteristics, including the desire to centralize power, track populations, demonize outsiders, and claim authority and neutrality without being accountable. Machine intelligence can be a powerful part of the power playbook, she said, and skipping down again. Another area where AI can be used is in building registries, which can then be used to target certain population groups. Crawford noted historical cases of registry abuse, including IBM's role in enabling Nazi Germany to track Jewish, Roma, and other ethnic groups with the Hollerith machine and the Book of Life used in South Africa during apartheid. Robert Mercer did a key part of his research developing some of the root technology in the AI with IBM. And again, noting that Donald Trump has floated the idea of creating a Muslim registry. We already have that. Facebook has become the default Muslim registry of the world, Crawford said, mentioning research from Cambridge University that showed it is possible to predict people's religious beliefs based on what they like on the social network. Christians and Muslims were correctly classified in 82% of cases, and similar results were achieved by Democrats and Republicans, 85%. That study was concluded in 2013, since when AI has made huge leaps. Crawford was concerned about the potential use of AI in predictive policing systems, which already gather the kind of data necessary to train an AI system. and then noting about the possibilities of manipulating voters, skipping down. "This is a fascist's dream," Crawford said, "power without accountability." Such, and then the authors come on to say, "such black box systems are starting to creep into government. Palantir," parenthetically, a Peter Thiel firm, "is building an intelligence system to assist Donald Trump in deporting immigrants." Quote, "It's the most powerful engine of mass deportation this country has ever seen," Crawford said. This concludes For the Record program number 952. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Update on technocratic fascism. This is being recorded on March 30th of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.